Sam. And I recall when Arsk was in London, people kept calling me Arsk, but I don't know. That's probably why. Yeah, exactly. Well, I didn't say that. But I am pleased. I just think it's great we're meeting with Sam. It's very difficult to, all this embarrassment of riches. And the riches start right now at 9 this morning with two talks, which I know are going to be fabulous, and I mean that just by getting to know, well, one person I've gotten to know, and Bill, of course, I've known a long time, and thinking about the many hats both these men wear, and they're going to bring this experience to us. Bill Klinger, as you know, is a collector and of cylinders primarily, and the chair of the ARSC Cylinder Subcommittee, but himself an electrical engineer in quality control, and he's brought that science into his work for ARSC with cylinders, and some of the best work that's been done for this organization on research in cylinders with this committee. Now he's doing research on stylus sizes. And he'll bring some of that fastidiousness, thoroughness to the research you're going to hear about today. As I said, he's an electrical engineer. You know, if you remember that power grid outage last year, didn't that start in Cleveland? I don't think Bill had anything to do with the problem, but I know that when they were figuring out how to prevent it, he proposed wind-up generators or something for the future. But anyway, Bill's work, as I say, all of his accomplishments that he's going to bring here, as you know also, he works on our discography committee and has done some good work with that. So you know Bill well. I'm going to let him come forward and talk to you a little bit about the U.S. Phonograph Company and other work. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Sam. I appreciate that. U.S. Phonograph Company, the Cleveland firm that dared to challenge Edison and Columbia. Get the credits out of the way first. All the original artifacts and documents you'll see are either from my own collection or that of my colleague, Dale Monroe Cook, or from the Edison National Historic Site. I want to really thank Bob Hodge and Sue Stenson because they've made all the transfers you'll hear. I'll play just a couple of little snippets, but my colleague Phil Carley will play a lot more in the talk that follows. Bob Hodge did some wonderful transfers. I think you'll really enjoy the sound, and I really appreciate the support from Syracuse University. You know, visitors who come to Cleveland today are likely to see these pyramids at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. But 90 years ago, there were another set of symbolic pyramids in Cleveland, Ohio. They were associated with the U.S. Phonograph Company. How did we come to have celluloid cylinders manufactured not in New York or Chicago, but in Cleveland, Ohio? And was this firm really founded by Albert Bensler, an Edison recording artist? You may know him playing the xylophone and bells. The problem is, in 1966, Major H.H. Anand, a British discographer, wrote that U.S. Phonograph was founded by Albert Bensler and Edison executives who broke away. I'm not so sure that's really true. What I'm going to talk about today isn't just this Cleveland company. I'm going to talk about the cylinder industry briefly in the U.S. There were five major manufacturers, and I'll give you an overview of their technology and how that industry developed. In 1889, when this oil painting was made, Thomas Edison had established the solid wax cylinder as a viable recording medium, and he was just beginning to produce music for entertainment, not just dictation, but putting music on wax cylinder records. In the early 1890s, most of the cylinder records were like this, soft brown wax, soft enough to be cut by a sharp-edged cutting stylus, but hard enough to be played dozens, maybe hundreds of times. In the 1890s, most cylinder records were heard in phonograph parlors like this. It wasn't a home entertainment medium yet. People would listen through ear tubes after depositing a nickel in a coin-operated machine. Recently, Patrick Feaster, ARSC researcher par excellence, found this photo from the November-December 1891 phonogram, and it shows the parlor here in Cleveland of the Ohio Phonograph Company. This was one of the first phonograph parlors outside New York City. It was established in the arcade just across Public Square in 1890. It still exists today. Room 163 in the arcade is exactly where this was. It's kind of given away by the curvature here at the bottom. You can see that curvature there at room 163 in the arcade. The arcade was the site for the Republican National Committee convention in 1895. And you can just see where the red arrow is at room 156, the ends of the word kinetoscope and phonograph. This was the Edison Kinetoscope and Phonograph Parlor at that time. You can see more of it where the red arrow is, Edison Kinetoscope and Phonograph. This arcade, built in 1890, was the first indoor shopping mall in the U.S. It spans Euclid and Superior Avenues. You can walk through it any time of the day if you're here in Cleveland. This is that same area in the arcade today. That's room 156, where the Edison Kinetoscope and Phonograph Parlor was. But for 10 years, Edison and Columbia both sought to find a more durable recording medium. They wanted something that was hard enough to be played thousands of times if possible. So they developed a harder black wax material. It wasn't meant to be recorded upon anymore. They were mass-produced and molded at a very low cost. Columbia produced this counterpart. The problem with all of these wax records is, if you drop them, they're gone. You hit them on the table, they're gone. Even contemporary postcards showed that young children and wax records don't go together very well. One of the first people to solve that problem was it really Thomas Lambert? The Lambert Company in Chicago, Illinois, produced celluloid cylinders, the first company to do so in the United States. And you can see on the end rim at the bottom of the patent date, March 20th, 1900. Well, that's a patent that was issued to this man, Thomas Lambert. He was definitely an inventor, but was he really a company founder? This is the incorporation document for the Lambert Company. And the red arrow shows an interesting name, Varian M. Harris, one of the three incorporators, along with Arch McCaig and Bill Gibson. No sign of Thomas Lambert on this document. In fact, it was really the Philpotts, Albert D. and Brian F., his brother, who founded the Lambert Company. In a 1903 court case, National Phonograph versus Lambert Company, Thomas Lambert testified, "The company was named without my knowledge or consent." By 1906, the Lambert Company was out of business, but that doesn't mean the Philpotts were done. The Philpotts moved to Brooklyn, established a factory in Albany, New York. They brought with them Frederick Matthews, a plumber and steam fitter who had been at the Lambert facility in Chicago, and they began producing a new type of indestructible cylinder record. This one had a surface of celluloid dyed black with a cardboard core and metal rings. Many of you collectors know this record well. They were so rugged, you could even let the polar bears play with them. Indestructible advertised that children can play with them or you can knock them off the table without danger of breaking them. Now, an interesting thing about this indestructible dealer's contract at the Red Arrow, retail dealers must not give away, sell, or offer for sale any indestructible records at less than the current retail price. This was literally a price-fixing agreement. It was typical practice in the phonograph industry at that time. This kind of control of the dealers and the distribution of records figures into this story. At this time, Edison was still producing only wax records, wax cylinders, but he was getting a lot of competition from the longer playing 12-inch 78s. He felt pressed to make something better. He produced a 4-minute cylinder record still using a hard black wax. He did that by increasing the groove pitch from 100 to 200 threads per inch. But he wasn't using celluloid because his one patent for molding celluloid had been ruled invalid some years earlier. Edison also had these restrictive agreements, and you can see at the lower left red arrow, dealers handling Edison phonographs or parts, etc., shall not handle any other make of cylindrical record. He was forbidding his dealers from selling those damned indestructible records. Columbia, too, at this time, was still producing only their wax record. Columbia, though, thought they'd better do something about this, and they announced in the fall of 1908, we have taken over the indestructible cylinder record. Well, they took it over by wrapping a paper label around the indestructible products made in Albany, New York. It wasn't too long before they announced to their dealers the beginning of the Columbia Indestructible Cylinder Records, October 1908, now packaged in this kind of container. Once again, the kids, the cats, could all jump around and play because these records, being hard and durable, won't break. They introduced that Columbia product in October 1908, and by April 1909, 3 or 4 months later, they were announcing, here goes the lid off the wax record business. We shall quit manufacturing wax cylinder records. In 1909, there was a big industrial exposition here in Cleveland. They built these fake buildings that only lasted for 6 months while they put on this expo. This is a souvenir program guide left over from that exhibit back in the benevolent days when the smokestacks produced a female figure that brought us trucks and ships and things like that. Inside that souvenir booklet, we see the Cleveland Phonograph Record Company making phonograph records. Well, were they really making them? They had an office in the arcade. They had incorporated in Cleveland in 1908. E.C. Beach was their president. F.W. Treadway was a former lieutenant governor of Ohio. I don't know yet what the other three men were doing. They had their offices here in the arcade. This is the Superior Avenue side. And you can see it's been turned into a Hyatt Hotel today. But if any of you have time to walk across Public Square and go through this arcade, I really encourage you to do so. Here's another photo from about 1900. I'm not saying that the red arrow marks the offices of the Cleveland Phonograph Record Company, but here's another window from this postcard. You can see it says Phonographs, Accessories, and Supplies. They had a factory at 1390 East 30th Street. Happily, that building still exists. Today, it's called the 1400 Building. At the far end of the building, there you go, 1390 East 30th Street. Cleveland Phonograph Record Company really wasn't ready to make anything yet in that factory. They were just setting up and developing their technologies. This patent date, which appears on all U.S. Everlasting cylinder boxes, December 11, 1906, was a patent granted to Varian M. Harris, that name we saw associated with the Lambert Company. When Harris was working with Lambert, making these celluloid cylinders, he was always frustrated because they used celluloid supplied by the Celluloid Manufacturing Company of Newark, New Jersey, in tube form, 6-foot-long tubes of drawn celluloid. The celluloid manufacturers had a limit as to how thin they could draw the celluloid. They found the tubes would rupture and split if they tried to make them too thin. Varian Harris wanted the thinnest possible celluloid because he felt the celluloid that Lambert and Indestructible were using was far too thick. It took too much pressure to get a good impression from the inside of the mold. His idea was to use the thinnest possible celluloid, but he could not get thin celluloid tubes from the celluloid companies. So he developed an approach using this apparatus. At the bottom, you see this circular affair. It's just a metal structure in which he takes a very thin sheet of celluloid, rolls it into a cylinder, and then he bonds the edges together with ether. Ether is held in this container, drips down through this tube, and the operator slides it along and literally seams the edges of the celluloid together and forms a celluloid tube. That gave Varian Harris the thinnest possible celluloid. And that may be one of the reasons we get better sound from U.S. cylinders than many other celluloid cylinders. He believed they could get a more faithful impression. Now, this is a familiar label to collectors of cylinder records. It's what you see on a two-minute U.S. Everlasting record box. But in 1991, I saw something funny inside one of my boxes. I unrolled the box and found this label printed inside, rolled up and hidden from view. Apparently, the Cleveland Phonograph Record Company was really planning to put out a Harris Everlasting record, a brand that had never been heard of before. Later, another collector unrolled a four-minute box and found a four-minute Harris Everlasting record label. But you can see the way this label isn't even registered properly on the paper. It's off-center. I don't believe that this strip of cardboard was ever really a box. It was just a printed flat strip of cardboard that was later reused, turned over, and the four-minute label for U.S. was put on the outside. So it's interesting that the company in Cleveland, before they became U.S. Phonograph, when they were still the Cleveland Phonograph Record Company, thought they would put out this brand. I don't think they ever did. The company changed their name on July 14, 1909, to the United States Phonograph Company. Their offices were at 235 The Arcade, but darn it, that Hyatt company changed it into a dumb old hotel room. This is the Euclid Avenue side of the arcade, and it's interesting that room 235 is here at this window. So the U.S. Phonograph Company had a rather prestigious place. They were one of the few offices in the arcade that had a window with an outside view. This Caxton building on South Huron Road, downtown Cleveland, it's an interesting piece of architecture, I think. Inside in room 320, the U.S. Phonograph Company set up Varian Harris with a laboratory where he worked with his assistant, George Christoph, developing this celluloid and other materials for the cylinders. U.S. Phonograph had their machine shop and factory in the Perry Building, 1013 Oregon Avenue. If you go looking for Oregon Avenue today, you won't find it. It's now called Rockwell, and Rockwell at East 9th Street is the site of this modern office building. So unfortunately, that factory can't be seen anymore. In that factory, we find F.L. Fritchie, the manager, a former Edison employee, working with Harry B. McNulty, developing the phonograph designs. At that time, in January 1910, they had eight people, including a draftsman, a toolmaker, two machinists, and three boys. This is Fritchie in 1905 when he was a salesman for Thomas Edison in Chicago. In 1907, he'd gotten a little bit more dapper looking. This is one of the early phonograph mechanisms. U.S. Phonograph decided to make a very simple, easy-to-use phonograph. To go from playing a two-minute cylinder to a four-minute cylinder on an Edison machine, you typically have to remove the horn, lift up the reproducer carriage, change reproducers, or change a button or a knob or a setting on the reproducers, and then you have to move another lever or knob to change the feed screw rate from 100 to 200 TPI. That's three or four, maybe five operations, depending upon the machine. With a U.S. phonograph, you turn this one lever. It moves the proper 2 or 4 minute reproducer into place, and that same motion drops the proper feed nut onto a feed screw, one twist of the wrist. It's probably the simplest combination phonograph ever made. The patent for it was actually issued to Harry McNulty, the Clevelander who worked in the machine shop. Thomas Towle is an interesting figure in Cleveland. He had been running the Eclipse Musical Company, a sheet music store. They sold musical instruments. Harry B. McNulty was one of his clerks before U.S. Phonograph got started. Thomas Towle's contribution to U.S. Phonograph is this strange, flexible metal connector, which they talked about being scientifically designed and allowing the horn to be moved to any position the listener prefers. In reality, it was probably just an avoidance of Victor's tapered arm patent. U.S. Phonograph announced their product line in the Talking Machine World issue of May 15, 1910. They were very proud of their new combination phonographs and the U.S. Everlasting Records. In the center of this document, you see a lot of handwriting. That is a notation from one of the secretaries in Thomas Edison's legal department marking this as exhibit number one in their court case against U.S. Phonograph. U.S. claimed a bunch of advantages for their machine, that very quick change mechanism we talk about, a very quiet motor, a flywheel, one of the first instances of a flywheel to smooth out the motion. They had a larger diaphragm than most Edison machines, and of course that flexible metal tone arm. On this example machine, thanks to Tim and George Paul, you can see the flexible arm, you can see the reproducer assembly, 2 and 4 minutes. Here's the flywheel over at this edge. Okay, where were the records recorded? Not in Cleveland. As far as I know, no recording was actually done in Cleveland. It wouldn't have made a lot of sense. The talent was in New York. That's where the artists were who recorded for Edison and Columbia. 662 Sixth Avenue was the site of the U.S. Recording Laboratory, but it was really Isaac W. Norcross's old laboratory. And you might remember Isaac W. Norcross as the maker of brown wax cylinders who was arrested in 1899 by Anthony Comstock for violating decency laws because he put bawdy cylinder records out under the counter. But U.S. turned to Isaac Norcross to make their first masters. They didn't like them at all. They sent a lot of masters. Most of them were unusable. They got former Edison employee John Kaiser to work for them, Frank X. Hofbauer, another ex-Edison man. Albert Bensler eventually signed on. But you know, Bensler was really still with Edison. I mean, his last Edison release came out 14 months after U.S. Phonograph was founded. So I don't think it's really true that Bensler founded the company. You'll hear a lot more about J. Louis Vondermaiden Jr. in Philip Carley's talk. And interestingly, Charles Hibbard, another ex-Edison man, brought his experience to U.S. Phonograph. In the mid-1920s, Hibbard became a renowned recording engineer for the OK Phonograph Company and made some superlative electrical recordings. This is Norcross's stationery writing to Joseph McCoy. This letter is signed by John Kaiser, the manager at the U.S. Recording Studio. It was sent to Mrs. W. Stanley Grinstead. And you may know that Grinstead is the real name of Frank C. Stanley. This is the condolence letter on Frank Stanley's death, written by John Kaiser, who also organized a tribute dinner and memorial concert in Frank C. Stanley's honor. Here we see in an old, roughly 1908, Edison recording photo, the staff of the recording studio, Hofbauer and Bensler. Hofbauer got a patent. It's interesting, he lived in East Orange while he was working at the recording studio in New York, but the patent you see is assigned to an attorney, George Iddings of Cleveland, Ohio, because he was obviously being funded by the U.S. Phonograph Company. This is that 1400 building we talked about, looking across the Interbelt Highway. Up on the third floor at 1390 East 30th is where the presses were located that produced U.S. Everlasting cylinders. This is just the back loading dock and the fire escapes. I once climbed up those fire escapes on a Saturday to take pictures and found myself staring at a cop inside the building. So who was up there in New York? Well, sometimes Hibbard was in Cleveland, sometimes Hibbard was in New York. They had the Grüttner brothers supervising things, and they had 23 factory workers in January 1910 producing these records, U.S. 2-minute and 4-minute. Now, here's an interesting testimony to the durability of U.S. cylinders. A June 1912 U.S. catalog supplement tells us that a U.S. Everlasting record in a Buffalo Penny arcade was actually played 44,000 times, according to the accurate register on the machine. It earned $440 for the establishment, and when carefully compared with a new record of the same selection, it was as good as ever, and one could not be distinguished from the other. Let's hear that piece. Peter Piper March. Albert Bensler. And the record cost 35 cents. Pretty good profit. U.S. also made a highbrow line of Grand Opera cylinders. They produced language instruction records for the R.D. Cortina Company of New York City. They were very interesting. They taught English to foreign immigrants, and they taught French, German, Spanish, and Italian to Americans. A really bizarre product line from U.S. Phonograph were these records made for the Medicaphone Postgraduate Company of New York City, a series of instructional records for doctors with exciting titles like cancer of the mammary gland and urinary dysfunction, good things like that. Red Pepper Rag, a spicy rag. Let's listen to that one. Van Epps, banjo. Albert Bensler, piano. I meant to show you these pictures of machines while that was playing, so we'll zip through these. U.S. made at least 9 different models of phonographs. Okay, Frank L. Dyer was general counsel to Thomas Edison, president of the National Phonograph Company. He was the one who oversaw all of Edison's legal interests. This is the interesting part for me about Edison versus U.S. Phonograph. In the fall of 1909, Edison's industrial spy, Joseph F. Gumshoe McCoy, met repeatedly with Varian M. Harris in Cleveland, attempting to gain access to the U.S. facilities and technical processes. He got that name Gumshoe because he had worked for Edison for 30 years already doing industrial espionage. He'd been a glassblower in Edison's lamp factory in 1880-something. And Edison would send him out to investigate new companies, dealers carrying competing product lines, all manner of things. This guy was a real piece of work. In Cleveland, he stayed at the Hollandon Hotel, talked repeatedly with Varian Harris. They'd go to dinner together. And I think this letter written by Varian Harris to Joseph McCoy on Hollandon Stationery says, your very welcome letter received, contents noted, and I extend my hearty cooperation to you in this proposition. I don't know exactly what that proposition was, but I suspect that McCoy was promising Harris employment or a consultancy with the Edison Company if he would spill the beans about what U.S. Phonograph was doing in Cleveland. Here's a sketch that Harris made for Joseph McCoy showing a record press used by U.S. Phonograph. In these notes, McCoy describes what he saw when he got into the factory. In this letter, a 12-page letter written longhand in that hotel to Thomas Edison on January 7th, 1910, McCoy says, they have 30 printers set up. Printers was their term for the presses that pressed the cylinders. They are the same as Harris's sketch. They have 5 lathes that are used for trimming the ends of the mandrels. That's the core that supports the celluloid tube. And the backings, 2 of these machines were in operation while I was in the room, and they were the only 2 people who were doing anything. Well, it was a Saturday afternoon, and they had finished their work for that day. An interesting remark here on that same letter, I counted while I was in the room 21 people, young girls and boys, who are employed by the phonograph company. Here's an interesting insight into what was happening at the recording studio in New York. McCoy writes to Edison, Now take the record end of the business. From July 1909 to January 1st, 1910, from the laboratory in New York, they have shipped over here 157 molds, and only 45 of them can be used, and they are not up to the required standard. The laboratory expenses in New York during that time has been nearly $54,000, so that their molds are costing them more than $1,000 apiece. Imagine that in 1910 dollars. Industrial espionage, okay. Harry D. Clark was another Edison employee. They sent him to the Doran Phonograph Company of Detroit, Michigan in 1911 just for the purpose of proving that U.S. phonographs and records were being sold by Edison dealers. This man bought a U.S. junior machine, 6 2-minute records, 6 4-minute records. When he was interrogated at a later court case, he was asked, basically, what's your job? Oh, it's principally on phonograph work, investigating price cutting, conditions of dealer stocks, whether they're living up to their contracts. I think that covers it pretty neatly. And you see at the bottom, he really went there specifically to buy a U.S. machine just so evidence would be gathered. They marked the cylinders, they scratched their initials into the bedplate of the machine, and all those objects were entered into evidence. There was a third attempt to get in and see what was happening in the factory. In May 1910, Frank L. Huff Jr., who was with the Edison Storage Battery Company, made arrangements to view the U.S. record process. He wrote about everything he saw after being taken through the plant by Charles L. Hibbard. So Edison's legal department gathered all this information about what was going on in Cleveland. And June 30th, 1910, they sent a letter to the United States Phonograph Company saying, "We have evidence you're infringing our patents, so on and so forth. Stop selling this stuff and give us money." They filed at least 4 different court cases. I won't go into all the gory details. They drew up detailed drawings of the U.S. phonograph mechanisms, how they compared to U.S. machines and others made in Europe. For 3.5 years, the law firm of Fay and Oberlin here in Cleveland, with offices in the Society for Savings Building on Public Square, had to fight this onslaught of court cases from Thomas Edison. But on May 21st, 1913, this letter from Fay and Oberlin tells the whole story. Every single Edison complaint was dismissed as invalid and inappropriate, and Thomas A. Edison Incorporated had to pay the costs that U.S. Phonograph incurred in defending themselves. The United States Phonograph Company changed their name to the U.S. Phonograph Company on September 4th, 1912. And it's interesting to see the names. None of these names are familiar to phonograph collectors. The people who were really behind this company are not the people you might expect, but Frank H. Ginn is a name that comes up in another connection later. U.S. had their factory and general offices on East 55th Street. All that's left of that building is this retaining wall today at the base of an industrial park. These are the people that were running the office. I mentioned before E.C. Beach, who was president until 1910, but now you find Kirk D. Bishop playing a role in this company beginning in April 1910. By that time, the fall of 1912, Edison had brought out his own celluloid cylinder. He had to buy the rights. He had to lease the rights to use celluloid from Brian F. Philpott, who was still operating the Indestructible Company. Another Edison employee, who had been the Western manager for Edison in the Chicago office, became the sales manager for U.S. Phonograph. But what's with this Bishop Babcock Becker Company? A lot of people ask me, every time they see that name, what was the association between U.S. Phonograph and Bishop Babcock Becker? Looking back at the 1909 Industrial Expo, we find that Bishop and Babcock Company was selling soda fountain equipment and beer equipment, things like that. Their president was Kirk D. Bishop. But they were an old company established in 1886 with offices here. The Bishop Babcock Becker version of the company wasn't actually incorporated until 1916. So although they were organized in 1912, they didn't really officially get going until 1916, and they were still operating in 1926 with offices here in this building. Now, this is interesting. This is a dealer's invoice. A dealer, George H. Muhlenberg, in a small town in Pennsylvania, had ordered 6 U.S. cylinders. You can see the price he paid at the end of December 1913. What's interesting about it is that most people who have written about U.S. Phonograph have said the company was out of business by 1913. The very next day, the same guy orders a few more records. Clearly, by April 30th, 1914, U.S. Phonograph was still in business, so the company really did continue into 1914. Unfortunately, a couple of years later, the company was gone, and the Charles Williams stores were closing out 35-cent U.S. cylinders for just 23 cents. And one way that Edison kind of shot himself in the foot was by all these restrictive conditions forbidding his dealers to handle any competing products. He wound up really being the sole player in the cylinder industry. Only the Albany Company limped along until 1922, Edison until 1929. How are we doing on time here? That's it. I think I'm going to call it quits at that. Philip, you're on.